The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Paul Hurd is our first inductee into the Culture Club here on The Last Word. You know Paul well, of course. He's the man for many years behind Ross O'Carroll Kelly, those fantastic books, and there's another novel coming out this year. But he also is the man who has made Copperface Jacks the musical, which was a massive hit last summer and returns in the Olympia Theatre tonight, isn't it?
Yeah, the first preview is tonight and then the official opening night is tomorrow night.
Okay.
Yeah, this is very exciting.
Is it updated? Cultural references such as Dublin going for the 5 in a row? Any updates?
Well,
like
actually,
that?
I went big last year, but they're going for the 10 in the row. So I kind of thought, just in case it's a show that's going to, you know, run for another 5 years.
I think it might be a safe bet.
Anyway, this was a running joke last year that, you know, Dublin going for the 10 in the row. And you could actually tell where people in the audience were from by the reaction. So we had a gang in from Kerry one night. And the boos from that section of the theatre when he mentioned we're going for the 10 in a row. It was a boo. They really don't want Dublin to win the 10 in a row.
How many nights did you go to see it when it was on last year?
I saw it quite a few nights. I mean, we did 4 previews last year because we're on safer ground this year because you kind of know what works and we've got the same cast.
Have you changed it a bit though?
Not really. I mean, there's some tweaks here and there, but... you know, there's some songs you kind of think, oh, that's a bit of a, you know, the rhyme isn't right there. Or you might think of something funnier when you're in the theatre watching it, but you don't want to be given actors notes, new things to sing while the run is on.
How nerve-wracking is it to be there, though, at the start to see what sort of reaction you'd get from the crowd? You know, if they went with this big expectations, Copperface Jacks is this cultural icon for generations of Irish people.
Yeah.
You've written this musical about it. And if they didn't laugh, how would you have felt?
Well, that's the terror. I mean, you never, with a comedy show, you never worry about, you know, things like reviews because, you know, comedy tends to get badly reviewed anyway. But the one thing you always fear is people are going to be sitting there looking at the stage and not laughing. And I'm kind of, I'm a wreck. Like, and I'm not nervous. I'm not nervous because I don't trust the actors. I'm nervous because I'm scared that I haven't given them lines that are going to elicit laughter. So what I tend to do is, and my wife Mary is always telling me to stop doing this, I sit there silently mouthing the lines for the whole show. So I saw the show, I think 8 times or 9 times last summer. The first 4 I had to see because they were previews. So we were still kind of tinkering with it at that stage. And then I went in with friends on different nights. And then I saw the closing night. But because every audience is different, like a Tuesday night audience is different to a Friday night audience and a Saturday. Well, alcohol has a lot to do with it. Like, you know, like to put it in crude terms, a Friday night audience will be far more generous with its laughter than a Tuesday night audience. And I think that goes right the way across the board. I notice it with the Ross plays as well. And I think it is a fact with theatre in general that Tuesday nights, the actors actually have to work a little bit harder to get the laughter. But because every night is different, you kind of don't want to miss one. You want to kind of see, you know, sometimes you miss a Thursday and the actors will say, or a Wednesday, the actors will say, weirdly, the audience was on fire last night. And because it's Copperface Jacks, a lot of our audience were guards and nurses. So they were coming off hospital shifts. And go so it wasn't the, you know, the normal rules didn't apply that sort of Thursday, Friday was your lively audience. Sometimes Wednesday night was a mad crowd, as it's a mad night in Copperface Jacks. Most of them were heading up there afterwards as well.
Fantastic. Listen, what we've asked you to do as the first person that we're bringing into our culture club, we asked you to go across your favourite movies, your favourite albums, your favourite gigs, your favourite TV show, your favourite books. But I'm going to start, given that we're talking about the stage. Your favourite play, theatre, show or musical was what you were asked. What's your nomination?
Book of Mormon. I saw Book of Mormon for the first time in New York, New York about 6 or 7 years ago. And it just blew me away. I mean,
I saw it on Broadway as well. It's one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
I mean, there's no way you could get away with it here. You know, I mean, it's so politically incorrect. I've got this theory about that.
Just explain what it's about.
Well, it's essentially about a group of Mormons who are sent off on their mission to various parts of the world to convert people to their religion, and the two lead characters, they're sent to Uganda and they turn up, and Uganda is represented on the stage in you know, a way that is not for the faint-hearted. And, you know, the lyrics and the songs, the subject matter, the things they're joking about and singing about, they've kind of pushed it. They've pushed it so far. If they were trying to be politically correct in certain parts, you would kind of say, well, they, you know, that's offensive, that's offensive, that's offensive. Everything about this is offensive. And they've pushed it so far that it's almost like it's almost beyond criticism.
We're going to play a clip. This is from the soundtrack to the Book of Mormon, and this is Man Up, sung by Josh Gad.
What did Jesus do when they sentenced him to die? Did he try to run away? Did he just break down and cry? No, Jesus dug down deep, knowing what he had to do. When faced with his own death, Jesus knew that he had to man up. He had to man up. So he crawled up on that cross and he stuck it out. And he manned up. Christ, he manned up. And taught us all what real manning up is about. And now it's up to me and it's time to man up. Jesus had his talk and now it's fine to man up.
I don't know what we can say about that, Paul.
It's so, I mean, it's so ridiculous and it's just so, it's so over the top as well. But I go to the theatre a lot, and so many times I leave a theatre just feeling like I haven't, just feeling a bit flat, like I didn't connect with something. And it's probably because I like comedy more than I like drama. And, but that show, I mean, I've been back to see it several times since, and I never get bored. The soundtrack is always on in the car. You know, I just listen to it. There's a song called "I Believe," and it's the moment when one of the Mormon preachers walks into the camp of the African warlord and tries to convert him. You know, and there's a great moment where the song just stops. And the warlord says, "Who the F is this?" And it's just joy. It's absolutely hilarious. And he's singing this sort of glorious ballad about, you know, about Jesus and the Mormon religion. It's fantastic.
You mentioned you prefer comedy to drama. So let's move on to television, because the clips that you've picked for television are very much definitely out of the comedy genre. Although you do like dramas like The Sopranos and The Wire and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's kind of, I suppose that's a recent thing, really. Discovered, you know, box sets in the last sort of 10 years. I suppose the whole nature of watching television has completely changed. I don't think 10 years ago I would have had the patience to sit down and follow a series over the course of 10 weeks or 12 weeks. But binge watching kind of really suits me. Like if I find something I like, I can watch hours and hours of it. The problem with, I mean, I mentioned some shows to you there about, you know, Breaking Bad and The Sopranos, Game of Thrones.
Oh, you got into Game of Thrones, did
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I really did, yeah. The, I mean, I like
sci-fi.
That's
not a barrel of laughs.
No, there's not many laughs in that, no. But, I mean, like, Tyrion is funny. I mean, there are funny characters in it. There's funny moments in it. But the thing about those shows is they've lifted the bar too high, really. Like, so all of my expectations of television series now are that. And I watch so many box sets now. I watch the first two or three episodes, and if they don't measure up, it's kind of ruined me in a lot of ways. Those shows, they're so good. I've kind of stopped watching movies as well, because they don't grab me the way those TV shows grab me.
Okay, but the television that you do like, and we're going to take two clips that you've actually picked. You have a big love for Victoria Wood. Why so?
I just, I mean, like, she's, I mean, she's, she was hilariously funny. I mean, you know, she did that thing, Acorn Antiques, she used to do on a show, and it was kind of a spoof of Crossroads. And it was just so brilliantly observed, the way the actors were always looking in the wrong camera, the way the set wobbled. I mean, it was a sort of mini masterpiece in every episode. I was mentioning a clip of a song called the Ballad of Frida and Barry.
We have that.
Right.
Will you explain it before we play it? Should we play it first?
It's the first time. I'll just say before you put it on. It's essentially, it's a story of a couple who've been married for a long, long time. And they're, one of them wants to have sex and the other one doesn't want to have sex. And it's the, you know, one of them is trying to entice the other. The woman is trying to entice the man, and the man is making all the excuses in the sun about why he wants to grout the tiles or all sorts of things that need doing around the house. But I remember watching this. It was on a live performance in front of lots of celebrities. So it was an audience with Victoria Wood. And it was the first time I actually thought I was going to herniate myself laughing at some of the lines in it. I don't know if you have the Woman's Weekly reference.
I think we might have. Let's hear this. Let's hear this. So is that the sort of the English inspiration for Copperface Jacks?
I love it. It's, I mean, just listening back to it there, it's very vaudeville, like, you know, it's that, you know, the ragtime piano and everything. And but I remember really clearly watching that with the whole family. In those days, families sat down together at 7 o'clock and watched the television for 3 or 4 hours before everybody went to bed.
Yeah, what was your formative television? Is it mainly English television?
Yeah, I mean, Yeah, when my friends talk about like children's television in Ireland, like, you know, Wanderley Wagon, I have no idea what they're talking about. Bosco, all that totally went over my head because I was raised in England, like until I was 8 years of age, we lived in England. So when we moved to Ireland, all of our tastes were English, really. So we watched things like Grange Hill. You know, that was our kind of television. I never watched any of that Wanderley Wagon stuff.
Okay, so that's why you're into things like Only Fools and Horses as well.
Yeah. I mean, I love English comedy. I love BBC comedy especially. You know, it's just, and Fools and Horses, again, it was one of those shows that, you know, everybody sat down to watch it. It was a communal experience. When you went into work after, you know, those early episodes, the first sort of, you know, 5 or 6 seasons of it, you went into school or you went into work and everybody talked about, did you see what happened in Only Fools and Horses? And some of the, especially the early ones when the granddad was in it, there's a great episode where they go to clean a chandelier in a stately home. And it's brilliant. It's almost like, it's like an old sort of Eton comedy or something. Like, it's kind of, the setup is actually kind of very, very old fashioned.
You also have a big love for Blackadder.
Yeah, love Blackadder.
We have a scene from the third series of Blackadder with Rowan Atkinson and Hugh Laurie. Which was the third series?
I always remember it as the Hugh Laurie series. So it was he was the prince regent. and Blackadder was the butler. It's almost like a Jeeves and Wooster thing. The butler is smarter than the boss, but it's Hugh Laurie's finest moment. I think it's genius.
Let's hear it.
Sir, if I may make so bold, a major crisis has arisen in your affairs.
Yes, I know, Blackadder. I've been pondering it all morning.
You have, sir?
Yes, socks run out again. Why is it that no matter how many millions of pairs of socks I buy, I never seem to have any?
Sir, with your forgiveness, there is another, even weightier problem.
They just disappear. Honestly, you'd think someone was coming in here, stealing the damn things, and then selling them off.
Impossible, sir. Only you and I have access to your socks.
Yes, yes, you're right. Still, for me, socks are like sex. Tons of it about, and I never seem to get any.
Sir, if I may return to this very urgent matter, I read fearful news in this morning's paper.
Oh, no. Not another little cat caught up in a tree.
No, sir. There is a vote afoot in the new Parliament to strike you from the civil list.
Well, yes, yes, yes. But what are they going to do about my socks?
Sir, if this bill goes through, you won't have any socks.
Well, I haven't got any socks at the moment.
Or trousers, shirts, waistcoats or pantaloons. They're going to bankrupt you.
They can't do that. Why, the public love me. Only the other day, I was out in the street, and they sang, "We hail Prince George! We hail Prince George!"
We hate Prince George. We hate Prince George.
Okay, let's move
could
on.
Also, that could almost be a metaphor for Brexit. I was just thinking about it, I was listening to it. Hugh Laurie's very Boris Johnson in that, actually.
Yeah, he is a touch. When you came to movies, you have picked Star Wars.
Yeah, yeah. Star Wars is the movie that really blew my mind as a kid, you know. I mean, I was the right age for it. I was 6 years old when the first movie came out, and dad took me to the cinema to see it, and it was just, you know, it was fantastic. When you look back, it's the whole notion of space. I mean, the science fiction had been around for a long time, but when the first Star Wars movie came out, it was only 8 years since man had walked on the moon. So it was kind of, this stuff was really new, you know, and this world that George Lucas had imagined with, you know, Chewbacca, like this walking carpet, 8 foot carpet, and these really, really clever robots who are called droids, and, you know, Luke Skywalker, the clean hero, just, and also those sort of clean lines between good and evil, you know, there's the dark side and the light side, this mysterious power called the Force that could, you know, you could move things around with it, and it just had everything, and it had a little bit of, you know, George Lucas sort of picked from lots of different genres. So like Han Solo was the sort of cowboy, you know, he's the kind of Saturday afternoon Western matinee hero. So it just had everything. And I was just the right age to come along. And
did you stick with it to the various iterations?
Yeah, I mean, we actually disturbingly so to the point where like we have a room in our house that's just dedicated to Star Wars.
What?
I know that sounds
Explain that
a little bit weird, Matt, you know? So I started collecting Star Wars toys. Like, so I got this Death Star for Christmas, and it's a cardboard thing. And it's a pretty amazing piece of kit, as those collectors call it. I think it was about seven when I got that, and that was the start of it. And I collected all the figures, and every single penny that passed through my hands between the ages of, you know, 7 and 14 went on Star Wars toys. Bought everything, every birthday, every Christmas, spaceships, figures, everything. I collected everything. And my parents, when I became an adult, my parents didn't stop buying me Star Wars toys for Christmas. So, like, you know, I think for my 30th birthday, I got this talking Jar Jar Binks that's about, like, 2 foot high. It was just, you know, they carried on, like, you know. So I had all of this stuff, and it was kind of in the eaves and in the attic in our house. And one weekend, Mary said to me, "Let's." Mary loves Star Wars as well. She said, "Let's put it like, let's just put it on the walls, like." So we got some wood, local DIY shop, got some wood and made these shelves. And anyway, it became a project, and I did. It took about 2 or 3 weeks. And now every single piece of wall is covered in Star Wars toys. They're hanging from the ceilings. And my revenge on my father is I make him sleep in there at Christmas when he comes and stays with us.
Presumably in a Star Wars Eiderdown or something like that.
There is a Star Wars duvet, you know, and the light has a light shade around it that's in the shape of the Death Star. So it's all Star Wars in this room. So I can't think of another movie or movie franchise I would do this for.
Did you follow all the movies through, though? I mean, when you get into all the various different iterations, backwards and forwards, have you enjoyed those?
Yeah. I mean, the thing about it is it's never going to, the new movies, they're never going to make you feel the way you felt about the very first ones, because you were 7, 10 and 13 when those movies came out. So you're never going to be that age again. But I suppose those new movies, they're aimed at a much younger audience. There's something in them for adults, but they're not really made for me. But I could still enjoy them.
Who are your inspirations when it comes to books? What do you read?
I don't read a lot of fiction. I would say 9 out of 10 books I read are non-fiction.
Despite the fact that you write fiction?
Yeah, yeah. I just find biographies more interesting. I find, you know, books about science, books about, you know, I mean, anything. I will read absolutely anything. I read a book recently about the poisons in Agatha Christie. All the different poisons that are mentioned in the books and how they work and stuff like that. I read books about the 60s. I just read a book about Benetton, the history of the company. I just find them more interesting. I don't know whether it's because I choose bad books. A lot of literary fiction leaves me quite cold. It just doesn't do anything.
The fiction
for me
that you gave the list of, a lot of them are things that would certainly make you laugh, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah, and that's it. I mean, that's
give us the examples.
That's what entertains
for
the me. Well, Enda McAvoy, my colleague from the Tribune,
the great hurling writer,
Yeah, a few years ago introduced me to the Flashman series of books.
What are those?
And so Flashman was a soldier during the Victorian period, and he went off to fight in all of these old kind of colonial wars, you know. So he fought in the first Anglo-Afghan war, and then he sort of finds himself, you know, at the charge of the Light Brigade. He's at the, you know, he's at the Little Bighorn and fights the Zulus. And at a certain point in his life, quite late in his life, he decides to sit down and write the true story of what happened in all these battles. So it's a series of 12 books. He's highly decorated. He's Sir Harry Flashman. He's got the Victoria Cross. He's on first name terms with Queen Victoria and Albert. But what he decides to reveal in his old age is that his whole life was a sham, and that he was a coward, and that in all of these battles where he's the only survivor, you know, of a battle, it's because he was hiding under the table or hiding behind a curtain. As well as that, he's a bully, you know, beats his servants.
This is not politically correct
stuff. No, it's really not politically correct. He's a fornicator, a misogynist. But George MacDonald Fraser's trick is to make him likable and to make you actually want him to succeed. You don't want him. He gets into all these hairy situations where you think he's about to die, but you're pulling for him. You don't want him to die.
Now, the track or the audio clip that we've pulled out is the most severe language warning I've ever had to give, apparently, on this programme. That if you were easily offended, you're going to be exceptionally offended
brought the tone down, really, with this. The first culture club.
But you have picked Irvin Welsh, who's been a guest in this programme previously. You've picked an extract from his Trainspotting novel. Why so?
Well, Trainspotting was the book, really, that made me want to read more fiction, because I'd never read anything like it before. Like I said, a lot of literary fiction left me cold. But he was writing about a world that I understood. He was writing about working class people from council estates. You know, in his case, Edinburgh. I grew up in a council estate in Dublin. He just seemed to be writing about things I knew about. And the language, he writes in phonetics. I mean, there is a link here that, you know, I've tried to do with Ross what George MacDonald Fraser has done with Flashman in making an anti-hero likable. And then with Irvin Welsh, it's that writing of phonetics. He writes, you know, can he do that? And it takes a long time when you're reading Irvin Welsh, especially Trainspotting, to actually get into the language. And I suppose I've written South Dublin in phonetics for a long time now.
Warning again, extreme bad language contained in this segment.
Now the doorbell's going. Fucking hell. That bastard, shite-arsed fuck-up of a landlord. Baxter's son. Old Baxter. God rest the diddy cunt's soul. Never really bothered about the rent check. Senile old wanker. Whenever he came round, I was charmed personified to the old cunt. I'd take off his jacket, sit him down, give him a canny export. We'd talk about the horses and the hips teams of the 50s with the famous five forward line of Smith, Johnston, Riley, Turnbull, Ormond. I never knew about horses or about hips in the 50s, but as they were all Baxter's only talking points, I became well versed in both subjects. Then I'd rifle through the old gadget's pockets and help myself to some cash. He always carried a massive wad round with him. I'd either pay him his own cash or tell the poor bastard that I'd already squared the cunt up.
Yes, more language in a minute than we've ever had, more bad language.
It's beautifully written and beautifully rendered as well, but it's the richness of the language. I just love it.
Okay, we're not going to have time to go through all of the music, unfortunately, that you have, and there's some great music here. Best gig you were ever at and why?
Well, two. Bruce Springsteen at the RDS in 2003. It was the Rising Tour. Just the passion he gives it, you know. I mean, that was a particularly brilliant album. I love that album. And sometimes you're just in the right mood for a gig, you know. And you know, there's a lot of artists have been pushed back out on the road because of falling music sales, because people are illegally downloading their music now. So they've been pushed out of retirement to tour the world. And a lot of them don't look very happy about it. I saw the Police in Croke Park a few years ago. None of them looked like they were actually talking
to
each other.
They were phoning it in.
Yeah, and they really didn't want to do it, like, you know. But Bruce Springsteen always looks like, this is the best. He wants this to be the best gig he ever played in his life. It was great. And then I saw Stevie Wonder in the Hollywood Bowl. It's probably about 8 years ago now, 7 or 8 years ago. Mary and I were in California and we just arrived from the airport. And we were driving by the Hollywood Bowl and we saw the sign and Mary said, let's go and get tickets. And I said, there's not a chance you will get tickets for Stevie Wonder in Los Angeles. We rocked up at the gate. It was 5 o'clock and they said, you're in luck. The house tickets, which were for complimentaries that nobody took up, were about to put them on sale. So we got this little kind of wooden pen. The Hollywood Bowl is very civilized. You have a little picnic table in front of you and you bring a picnic and, you know, you drink a bottle of wine while watching the gig. It's an amazing venue. And we saw Stevie Wonder and we were probably 20 yards from the stage. And it was amazing. And he played all of his hits. It wasn't like last night's gig. He started in the 60s and he played right up until the present day. It was amazing.
I remember a couple of years ago you were tweeting about going to see the hologram of Roy Orbison as well.
Yeah.
Do you really go and see these gigs of holograms of dead stars that you love?
I hope on top of the Star Wars room reference that this doesn't sort of, you know, suggest that I'm strange in any way. But the Roy Orbison hologram gig was fantastic. It was just too short. Songs in those days were about 2 minutes long.
Yes.
So his hologram breathed through the whole set, like 19 hits in about 48 minutes. And then everybody was confused leaving. It was still bright outside
they
when we
left.
Should
have just done it again.
Well, he's coming back this year and it's a hard sell to try and persuade Mary to come with me. But he's coming back with Buddy Holly. A hologram of Buddy Holly.
Okay. Your favourite album and favourite band? Your favourite band, because we mightn't have time to get your albums.
The Beatles.
Is that what inspired your fantastic book about the life of Tara Brown?
Yeah, it's that album. It's Sgt. Pepper. It's that great track that closes the album, A Day in the Life, and the opening lines, that sort of haunted Lennon voice singing about Tara Brown.
Let's hear some of it.
Thank you.
time, so I hate having to talk over that. But why do you love the Beatles so much?
A lot of times it's whatever music you get into when you're young. And we lived in a house in which my parents just talked about the 60s all the time. And the 60s was this golden period in their life because they were both young. They had left Ireland and they were starting this new life together in England. And, you know, it's I suppose they just associated with really, really happy moments in their lives. So I kind of grew up in a house where I felt nostalgic about a time I didn't live through, and the 60s were, and the Beatles, you know, the Beatles were always on in our house. And I think there's three songwriting geniuses there, because, you know, George Harrison was a genius as well. And I always think, what are the chances of them all meeting? Like, what, like Paul McCartney and John Lennon finding each other, crossing paths, is that's amazing enough, you know, but George Harrison as well coming along, and you know, there's something really magical about that. And all these songs they produced, and they're just such different songs, and they're all brilliant in their own ways.
You had as your favourite albums also Born to Run by Bruce Springsteen, who you spoke about, Astral Weeks by Van Morrison. Also, your first ever album. We won't be able to play anything out of it, but you've both 10 seconds to tell us what it was.
The first record I ever bought was Casey and the Sunshine Band, Baby Give It Up.
That's your thing. And the album. I don't like your single, but I love your album.
The album was
ABC's The Look of Love.
Oh, yeah, The Lexicon of Love. Yeah. I mean, that was, and it was everything about that album. It was the cover. It was the fact that, it looked like stage directions, the way the cover design was, but the writing on the cover.
Listen, unfortunately, I'm out of time. I could talk to you for ages more. You have been a fantastic first guest on our Culture Club here on The Last Word on Today FM. You set a high bar for everyone else to reach.
Paul Hart, thank you very much
for being with us. And best luck with Copperface Jacks, the musical, which of course starts this evening. Where's it on? The Olympia.
Thanks, Matt.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.